bringing manufacturing back to America, creating high wage jobs, significant manufacturing jobs.
Jobs and growth.
Bringing our jobs back. The good jobs, the real jobs.
Good jobs.
700 new jobs.
How do you create enough jobs?
800 jobs. 1,800 new jobs. 7,000 jobs. Create 10,000 jobs.
20,000 jobs.
Create 50,000 jobs.
It's promising to create 300,000 new jobs.
Many, many millions of jobs.
5 million new jobs.
But unfortunately, that has not translated into jobs.
How do you create enough jobs?
Job creation.
Jobs and growth.
To create British jobs. For British workers.
Jobs and growth.
Getting veterans hired, and not only hired, but getting them jobs that are commensurate with their skills and abilities.
For jobs and growth.
You deserve more job opportunities.
The future is automation.
Future job creation.
Robots don't need health care. Robots don't sue. Robots don't do the slip in pay or whatever you call it.
You have to have automation. You have to have automation. You have to have automation.
Bringing manufacturing back to America. Creating high wage jobs.
But he's also smart on the realities of automation.
Well, I'm sure you heard these emphatic, unfulfilled promises before, did you not? Hi, I'm Martin Janssen, and I welcome you to Kaput Radio. Today's episode is in two parts. It deals with automation and the vexed question of global finance. Lately, one regularly finds news website articles, essays, and academic material all trying to debate the increasing trend of automation in the workplace and in many areas of the leisure-pleasure industry. What these publications lack in dealing with this issue is the close connection with global finance. The implications go largely unrecognized, or else they are misconceived. Kaput Radio dealt with the basic ideas and historical background in a podcast, Kaput X Radio number 324, with the provocative title Arbeit macht frei, a connotation of the German Nazis putting Jews and dissenters in concentration camps to work as slaves. This provided cheap labor force for industrial production in many areas of the then German economy. Today's two presentations are going into more depth with a thorough background from a perspective of the global finance system. Welcome to the show.
A Robotized Society is a Worker's Lament by Graham Ferguson. Martin Ford's recent book, Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future, surmises we are at a point where robots, if not correctly managed, could be the catalyst for mass unemployment and economic collapse. We could well question why on earth a jobless future should be seen as threatening. It is the obvious which is so difficult to see most of the time, said Isaac Asimov in his book I, Robot, back in the 1950s. People say it's as plain as the nose on your face. But how much of the nose on your face can you see unless someone holds a mirror up to you? Also from iRobot, the three laws of robotics. 1. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. 2. A robot must obey the orders given to it by humans, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. 3. A robot must protect its own existence, as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. So, let's ask an Asimov-type mirror about the reality of our human condition. So, mirror, mirror on the wall, haven't we all, since the first stick and stone tools, been working towards a technology that gives us time and leisure to develop our potential as civilized, compassionate beings? True, says the mirror. But recently you have been focused on your profit growth, too. Yes, we already have highly developed technology. But instead of the once hoped for leisure and compassion, we are being forced to think jobs. We use modern technology to train increasing numbers of redundant, low-skilled workers, while decreasing the need for human involvement. Incredibly, a rationale for this does exist. Will the redundant worker lament the loss of hyper-competition of contesting for jobs? Jobs that ostensibly exploit and destroy all resources, human and environmental? Or is it the job or the incomes for which we have to fight each other? This unfortunate situation may have produced another conditioned response from the righteous right, such as, heaven protect us from the hordes of indolent idlers. Whatever shall they do in a jobless world? Just imagine that aimless and godless future landscape, populated with shiftless mobs of jobless, roaming around without the discipline of work to keep them from thinking. The masses thinking? Heaven forbid! Dear me, that would never do. Even if they haven't a job, they've been trained to think and dream only jobs, haven't they? But what if jobs have no future? The most rudimentary grasp of psychology reveals that the evolution and development of technology arose from our very human dislike of work, probably long before language had a word for it. We have, forever backwards, sought ways to lessen and or remove the burden of work from our lives. Throughout history, we've applauded the development of labour-saving and energy-producing devices. The primal worker that developed the first labour-saving device would also have been lauded, rewarded, and copied. This applied particularly to farmers, working mainly for themselves. Originally, food production was hard work, with meagre production, a situation no farmer, no human prefers. So labour-saving devices came thick and fast, from the sharpened sticks for scratching the ground to stump-jump ploughs and combine harvesters, from water buckets to push-button irrigation, from animal power to air-conditioned tractors with stereo, Wi-Fi, and a drone delivering lunchtime pizza. Today we've enhanced our water wheels, hydropower, enhanced our windmills, wind turbines, our solar and methane producers to service our enhanced energy needs. To do what? You've guessed it. To power our labour-saving devices. We have, forever backwards, sought ways to lessen or and remove the unenviable burden of work from our lives. Throughout history, the development of labour-saving and energy-creating applications have been a focus. Have we done all this to provide work? Is the must-have jobs lobby for real? Is being less intelligent than an AI machine defining us as human? Think slaves, wage or otherwise. Slaves of many shades and designations, from animal to human to powered machines and on to automation. Hopefully we may eventually welcome technology that ends tiresome toil and deplore the meagre wages, the meagre income, for which we devote a major section of our adult lifespan. However, future workers will be robots and computers, our future mechanical slaves, but whose thinking skills are still a work in progress. Even so, the latest computer has just beaten the world's best players in a game of poker. It's a guessing, bluffing, and body language task far more difficult for technology than chess, with its hard and fast rules. Introduced here could be our name for the coming on stream feminine version of AI. The name robot, so close to Robert, has a maleness about it. So, not wanting them labelled as sexist, we think Robette has the right feminine connotations. Very appealing connotations they are too. International Robette's Day could well become a future celebration, don't you think? A humanoid that is gendered feminine has the more widely known name of Fembot. Fembots appear in science fiction, film and art, and as the design is technologically possible, they are also emerging in real-life robot design, says Wikipedia et al. But lovely as the feminine bot is, we shall perhaps stick with our freshly minted, newly coined name of Robert. The story of our loss of work to artificial intelligence recalls the exploitation of poor, overworked, underpaid textile mill workers of yesteryear. Were those oppressed workers protesting at the mechanisation of looms? Or were the protests aimed not at the loss of jobs, but at the loss of income? However, the anomaly remains, since the wage income and the price of produce are antithetical. Given adequate income for an adequate living standard, would hand loom weavers still prefer to be tied to a job, shackled like a slave, a wage slave, to a machine, the repetitive work lasting 12 to 16 hours a day? Already, computerized automation could, and does in places, control the whole weaving assembly line, or even the whole factory, letting the weavers have the day off and go to the beach. minus income, of course. Would they or any other human not find better, more fulfilling and beneficial ways to pass their days? Perhaps we could continue on from where the thinkers of ancient Greece left off. They had their automation in the form of slaves, as was the fashion. So they used their spare time in developing their intellects as well as their physiques. If they hadn't been so rudely interrupted by those primitive Romans and their work ethic, automation may have arrived much sooner. This possibility has not yet been investigated. The Romans' quest for leisure was achieved through the power of armed force and constant colonial subjugation. But their leisure was misused, profligate, wasteful, and eventually their undoing. Does our first world love work so much that it has generously exported most manufacturing jobs offshore to much cheaper third world labour in search of profit growth? They produce the much cheaper goods we all enjoy in our now casual work culture. With a scarcity-based finance running the economy, production costs must be kept to a minimum using a low-budget casual workforce, while profit growth has to be maximised. And wages are the cost of production. We fondly imagine that wages, incomes, meet the price that must be set by industry to recover cost. Yet profit can only increase through wage decreases and price increases. Immediately it is introduced to it, the simplest, most rudimentary of AI machines will pick up on this several centuries old, idiotic quirk of our finance. This brings us back to our overall conditioned work ethic response to AI, with robots taking the worker's job. In his book, Five Minds for the Future, Harvard professor Howard Gardner makes the case for, and I quote, cultivating a disciplined mind, being someone who can bring their attention to a laser-like focus and drill down to the essence of a subject, perceiving the simple truth of it, then take this clarity to the next level by combining multiple ideas in new ways to create something interesting and perhaps useful. This, done by the synthesizing mind and the creative mind. He calls this thinking skills for future workers. However, future workers will, hopefully, be robots and computers, our future mechanical slaves. Imagine the professor's disciplined, laser-like mind focused on, would you believe, creating jobs for us. Oh, joy, he proposes a method that gives us work. Through the, quotes, cultivating a disciplined mind bit, with a laser-like focus drilling down to the essence of a subject, so to perceive the simple truth of it, the act has great merit. It's what we aim for in our talks on these social issues. It's the present way of financing our economy that has demanded our indelibly imprinted work ethic morality. The righteous and moral teachings of our education, from beginning to end, from kindergarten to tertiary, it seems, were and are but an endeavour aimed at instilling the work ethic into the psyche of our proletariat. But certainly, if you've been drilled, demoralised, conditioned, educated for generations to believe in the work-for-work's-sake work ethic, and the political mantra of jobs, jobs, jobs and growth, as a lot of us have, you too may recoil in revulsion at the image of a future godless, idyllic idleness. This heretical work-free concept of cheap labour had to be kept from the lower-cost labour of our working-class wage slaves. Historically, the good old work ethic has resulted in lowering wage costs and bringing much leisure, but not for the workers. Contrarily, some of us still consider sound work ethics and the willingness to work the benchmark of good, honest citizens. But our economy, run on the scarce finance model, could do well to realise that at least one impetus pushing the coming age of AI along is not the love of work, but our very human desire to be rid of it. Hopefully, leisure, cheap goods, and the profitability will all result. But with the demands of our present scarce finance economy, the other intent is not actually to free humanity from burden, boredom, and drudgery, but to achieve profit growth. To the aristocrat, even the thought of work was unacceptable. But certainly if you've been drilled, moralised and conditioned for generations to believe in the work-for-work-sake ethic, as a lot of us have, you will probably recoil in revulsion at the thought of this future godless idyll. Also, this heretical work-free concept had to be kept from the low-cost working-class wage slaves. Herewith the rationale for instilling the work ethic. Post-slavery, to keep the masses satisfied with this arrangement, God had to be brought into it. Our privileged classes wrote the curriculum and saw to it, with a little help from clergy and government, that it was considered culturally mandatory to encourage the underprivileged classes to attend church and to send their children to Sunday school. Older kiddies attended religious education classes at school. Good old RE. So the work ethic and the word ethic itself, plus God, became inextricably enmeshed in the minds of the toiling masses, and guilt weighed heavily upon any shirkers. The lower classes, though poor but industrious, could now feel like upstanding, righteous, proud citizens. Well, most of us did. The leisure class and the aristocracy were exempt. The church and the aristocracy, the old names above civilization's door, have been replaced by three others: the very rich, the extremely rich, and the super rich. They comprise a tiny proportion of the world's population, just how it's always been. The titles may have changed, but the great divide between the working and the leisure class remains as a gap that continues to widen. In a fully automated world, will all humanity be at risk of redundancy, or only the worker? In this talk, the Stephen Hawkins quote was extracted from the Journal of Economic Reform, Era Review, January-February 2017, edition, page 17. Regarding the accelerated development of artificial intelligence in the workplace, Stephen Hawkins, from a recent article in The Guardian, speaks of, and I quote, "small groups of individuals making enormous profits employing very few people." This description of profitable enterprise, couched in negative terms, displays a complete unawareness of our fiscal reality and only serves to further befuddle the public befuddlement surrounding this issue. Well, if we objectively compare the number of separate fiscal instances with one another, till we see the common factor that gives rise to them, we have arrived at the cause, giving us the rationale behind the law of profit growth. What even a great mind like Hawkins is focused on is but one fiscal instance with one effect, in a procession of incidents resembling a wave-like readout of the pulsating finances of our economy. Each instance creates an economic effect at some point of the wave. The profits, he criticizes, are in the next instance deployed back into circulation via investment, maintaining the jobs that are financially possible. However, until we gain a firm intellectual grasp of the cause leading to this train of effects, we are only then in a position to ring in the change we all seek. If this cannot be grasped, the meaning of all those instances will be lost in time, like tears in the rain of a climate, changed by clouded minds. Global finance, the cause; unwelcome change, the effect. Change global finance, welcome the effect. The achievement of profit growth in any commercial enterprise secures the income of all those involved, from the lowliest paid worker to the CEO and his company's investors. Profit provides the money circulating in the global community, from which all our incomes are derived. The more enormous the profit, the more secure our overall incomes. That is, till full robotization. The ups and downs of the waves readouts are all instances that lead up to profit growth or down to economic recession or worse. If the base of the descending wave line flatlines and stays for a time, watch out recession. Profit growth is the community's money in circulation that enables the cost of industry's produce to be recovered by prices. The disposable part of any of our incomes is spent in the global marketplace, and the surplus is invested back into industry. This type of financial income is the lifeblood circulating in our present global economy, run by the profit growth motive. Other questions arise when following the money trail of these enormous profits. We quickly discover they're not in a vault, under the mattress, or in the Caymans. They are actually back in circulation through spending or investment in a profitable industry, providing whatever jobs there may be. Our money, unless earning its keep via investment or shareholdings, continually loses value. It must, therefore, continually earn. Is there actually any money just sitting idle anywhere? Is it not all invested? And would not that investment be in at least some kind of industry, which means that wage or shareholder income brings money back into circulation? A pertinent question to ask our finance-deprived economy could be, does money ever leave the marketplace? Or does it just circulate through our economic ebbs and flows, getting ever more scarce and dearer due to the draining effect of profit growth? Global banking is really just another industry. It does the processing of the bank finance-produced product, money. As with all industry, this product is subject to the absolute law of profit growth or fail. As with all other industrial product, the money product can lose all value if the law of profit growth is not maintained to the letter. All our resources are vitally necessary to us, but not to the money product. In our finance-driven economy, they can, and all too often, do become useless, even a burden. What if the economy can't afford the price of goods that's required for profit growth in energy, food, transport, or housing? Vital as these products may be, if they cannot be financially accessed, they cannot be used. These either remain in the ground or have to be buried at cost, or you live without a roof and go no more. It matters not how much they are needed. Yes, too many people worldwide, due to our wondrous finance system, get to go somewhere they go without. Try living on $1 or $2 per day. If the banking industry cannot maintain profit growth, their product is useless too. It loses all value. And there have been many instances of this. There are many who still find it difficult to see money as a product, and especially a useless product. But there it is. That's how it is. Unfortunate as it is. The relation between economic phenomena and the political organization of society is central to our historical understanding of economics as the driver of our culture. The effort spent gaining an understanding of this societal driver is so worthwhile. It leads to undreamed insights into the formation of our present civilization, our culture, our attitudes. Its function determines what we do to others and what they do to us. The dissolution of past civilizations can be attributed to factors other than the misunderstanding of money. If we look at what we know of earlier societies in regard to their accurate perception of money, we can see their eventual descent into dissolution was due to other factors. In general, their money served as an actual representation of a physical value. But their understanding of sustainable production methods of staples may have been lacking. Which is all very fine, but, and this is where it all goes pear-shaped, because in time our perception, our understanding of what money is, became confused. Instead of as a representation of goods and services, it changed to a representation of itself as the value. It became a good, an actual product. As a good or a product, it is now produced by banking institutions as a product and comes into circulation when a bank uses it to buy anything from the marketplace. Profit, once obtained, must be kept not in the fridge, but in a constant state of growth. However, the satisfaction we get from profit growth is only temporary, as the stressful struggle for more must continue unabated. How did the modern concept of profit arise? Profit growth is and always was dependent on cheap labour. It provides growth by using low-paying jobs on low rates. From bare subsistence through to meagre, though stable, income, the workers of the early Industrial Revolution eventually found their strength and confidence in unions and guilds. The local cheap labour then began making pay demands through strikes, and one by one have priced themselves out of a job. The so-called British Empire evolved mainly through the colonisation of cheap labour in foreign, densely populated lands, rich in primary resources, ripe for exploitation, using their locals for cheap labour. The law governing success in business says, grow your profits or fail. It is not something that can be overruled by group demand for better wages or conditions without pricing itself out of a job. The job just goes to cheap labour elsewhere. It's the law of monetary system under which we all try to survive. Lower the costs and increase the profit. Produce as cheaply as possible so you can sell at a profit. In a more mild form, our modern-day economy may already have experienced a similar situation to our foreseeable automated future. Our modern Western nations' factories since the early 1970s have moved most manufacturing offshore and used incredibly cheap Chinese labour. They make all our goods at little cost, and so we both make enormous profits on the global export market. With the oh-so-cheap imports, we in the West have afforded to live on the dole, the benefit, the pension, casual work or 4 to 5 hours work a week on a low hourly rate of pay. That 40-odd year period of using cheap labour away offshore, out of sight, may have been just a little practice run, giving us just a little taste of our jobless, automated future. If we extrapolate from this cheap labour, affordable product period to the fully automated future, we find that export would still play a most important economic role. Apart from some primary export to where needed, tourism would play a large part in our workless world. Our Western focus would no doubt be on the third world again. It comprises 2/3 of our global population and probably the largest chunk of the world's interesting geo-tourism and holiday destinations, that they could continue to offer the West at cheap rates. The West's island continent in the Asian region offers wondrous wildlife, vast expanses of blue skies, especially if artificial intelligence re-establishes the climate that sustained us. So tourism would still remain top as a source of revenue. Global art in all its many forms, like live theatre with great food and location-sourced wine, these traveller attractions and enticements could be, will be, forthcoming to fund our future incomes. So is this a snapshot of our past, present, or rather compressed, fast and accelerating future world society, compared to the manner we have traditionally imagined our culture evolving? It does seem, as Lenin wrote all those years ago, yesterday came suddenly.
Thank you for your interest on this subject matter. I have to thank Graham Ferguson for writing these articles from his series about the financial scarcity-based system, and Dr. Len Martin for his devoted presentation of the subject. I used extensive media clips for the introduction collage, and there are also sources quoted such as Martin Ford, Isaac Asimov, Howard Gardner, and even Stephen Hawking. Also useful articles appeared in the Guardian.co news website by Tim Dunlop and others relating to this subject. My name is Martin Jensen, and you will hear more Kaput Radio podcasts in the future.